Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Jovan Scott Lewis about his new book, Violent Utopia, Dispossession and Black Restoration in Tulsa. Dr. Jovan Scott Lewis, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Omari.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Lewis, I wonder if you could just begin the interview just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. You know, so I am an associate professor and chair of geography at UC Berkeley. My work largely, is concerned with the experience of, racialized impoverishment. In other words, what are the lives, conditions, and aspirations for, poor Black people? And thinking about those conditions as part of a kind of continuing legacy of, Black Atlantic life. And moreover, how do we think beyond just the injury and some of the kind of difficulties of those conditions towards coming up with a framework for repair, reparations? And so as a result, in addition to the work that I do in my scholarship on reparations, I'm also a task force member of the California State Reparations Task Force, which is a governor-appointed position that I've been on since June of 2021, and which actually ends this coming July with our recommendations to the state for reparations for Black Americans.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to that report myself, personally. But so on this particular book, on this, how did you come to this project?
Yes. So, Violent Utopia is a project that I've always been asked, how did I come to this project or the research? Because, I'm also Jamaican. And so when I began this research in 2014, everybody was really curious, as to why I, a Jamaican, who wrote my first book, on Jamaica, was somehow in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And mind you, this was, prior to, the release of The Watchmen and, that kind of period between 2019 and 2020, where the kind of history of Greenwood became, even more popularized and I would argue even celebrated. So, I came to this research because I was a postdoc. I was, I got my PhD from the London School of Economics in the Department of Anthropology in 2014. And following graduation, I had the opportunity to join a research project that, took the researchers to various places. Some of us went to Madagascar, some of us went to Taiwan, and some of us went to Tulsa, Oklahoma. I went to Tulsa, I arrived in Tulsa in 2014 as part of a project that was really there to kind of, from an anthropological standpoint, understand the relationship of cooperation within communities and between communities. And in particular, I was interested in studying the relationship between, Black, community formation and cooperation. And so I got there as a result of this postdoc, and it was a year-long postdoc, and, things could have ended there. But I really did come to appreciate the history and the complexity of the narrative of Black life in Oklahoma. And so I continued to return. And so that's how I got there. And I think, you know, the book itself is a testament as to why I continue to do my research there.
Absolutely. So you have this wonderful note explaining sort of your use of riot and massacre with throughout this work. I wonder if you could take us through your use of those words and how you sort of came to that understanding of what to use in this work.
Sure. And so in a way, it kind of does require going back to, you know, 2014 when I got to Tulsa. And, you know, as I state in the introduction to the book, I arrived in Tulsa, you know, really the week after Mike Brown was murdered in Ferguson. And I was really struck by the fact that there was, you know, very little, you know, protest, you know, to be found in Tulsa, despite it being, you know, just a 5-hour drive away from Ferguson, Missouri. And so the history of the Tulsa race massacre really wasn't, you know, something that community members discussed a lot in 2014 when I arrived. And so in many ways, the language, you know, around that incident and its particular history really comported with what was at that point the accepted, you know, terminology, which was riot. So it was known as a Tulsa race riot. And it wasn't until about 2017, you know, as local organizers, especially, you know, a few years away from the centenary of the 21 race massacre, began to organize around, you know, that history. You know, a movement for reparations had been, you know, renewed, despite it being attempted, you know, in the late 90s, in 2000, 2001. And there was an attempt to, I think, recover, you know, some of the kind of basis for, you know, the kind of claim making that's possible around such a horrific, you know, incident. And so, you know, organizers began to switch the language from riot to massacre because they wanted to try and get at the severity and, again, the horror of, you know, the 2 days of brutality and murder and destruction that took place in 1921. And so for me, you know, I wanted to kind of reflect the evolution of that language, but I also wanted to, you know, honor that there were still some people who used the word, right, riot to explain what happened. And beyond just, you know, accepting the choices of individuals and their preferred terminology, it was important for me to actually get at some of the complicated activities that occurred during the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. Meaning, depending on which aspect of the overall Tulsa, you know, community you were looking at, both a riot and a massacre took place. And so when you're looking at what occurred, right, what the experiences were of Tulsa's Black community, you know, despite the fact that we need to, you know, set the record straight, you know, Greenwood residents, they fought and fought very hard, you know, and they received shots and they sent shots right back. But on the whole, when you look at the devastation to their community, and that's, you know, that's to the lives lost, hundreds of lives lost that are accounted for, as well as the complete devastation to infrastructure and people's homes and businesses, it was a massacre. But I also want to recover the use of the word riot, because I want to really help to convey really what we can understand as a kind of, you know, the presentation of a particular kind of white violence and how it presents and how it shows up and how it operates. And so the term riot for me needs to still remain, you know, in play, because it actually does help to get at, you know, what was, you know, in the hearts of the white terrorists. That's what we should really call them. And it allows for us to, I think, create a kind of custodianship between different kinds of activities by especially, you know, what we might think of as disgruntled, you know, white citizens in this country who have used violence and terror as their primary instruments of reordering society, you know, to their preference. And so for me, riot and massacre are both required to get at the comprehensive set of activities that took place on those 2 days in 1921, but also that continue to take place today. And so we can continue to see Black communities being massacred, you know, by a variety of mechanisms. And we can continue to see, and we know, you know, January 6th, the January 6th, Capitol riot is an example, once again, you know, of a kind of continuing practice of, you know, some white Americans not seeing society, you know, go in a direction or operate in a manner to their liking, and using violence, you know, as a corrective means of, you know, returning society to, you know, their preferred formation and practice. And so riot and massacre are both necessary. And that's why I use both of them in the book.
Awesome. And you have this wonderful sort of diversity of sources that you're using within this work. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about some of the sources that you use and how you sort of use them in this work to sort of build this narrative.
Sure. So, you know, we have to understand that the history of Tulsa is one of a booster town. And so when oil is found in and near Tulsa, 1903 and 1905, it's important to know that oil is found just prior to the founding of Greenwood. So the Greenwood District, you know, later known as Negro or Black Wall Street, is formally founded in 1906. And so they really are, you know, developing at the time where Tulsa is becoming recognized as really an oil epicenter in the world. And so the 1921 Tulsa race massacre happens, you know, 15 years basically after, you know, Tulsa, you know, has this kind of oil boom. You know, it happens about 15 years, you know, or so after Greenwood is founded. And so it is very much a young city. It is a young city with a lot of economic promise. And so after the, you know, as a result of the race massacre, immediately following the race massacre, you know, it was widely publicized. You know, there were, you know, gruesome postcards, you know, showing the devastation of those 2 days that circulated. You know, newspapers wrote editorials, local newspapers in Tulsa wrote editorials. The New York Times, you know, had an editorial in the days following the massacre about what happened there. And so in many ways, one would suspect that there would be a trove of primary resources. However, because Tulsa was a booster town, you know, the kind of the entrepreneurial and industrial, you know, elite in the city, you know, and civic leaders as well, actually entered into a state of panic. Because who wants to do business in a place, right, that is, you know, now known as much for race riots and massacres as it is for a booming oil industry. And so Scott Ellsworth, historian Scott Ellsworth, has a wonderful book that he goes and details really this cover-up operation, right, that made actually finding, you know, the story, as it were, really difficult. You know, and so as a result, for me, you know, the research for this book relied on what primary information, what primary resources were available. There were, you know, a bunch of books, right? There have been a lot of books. Mine is not the first. It certainly will not be the last book written on the Tulsa Race Massacre. It shouldn't be, at least. There are a lot of secondary literatures that were very helpful, right, in detailing, you know, some aspects of everyday life. But for me, you know, in thinking about what kind of archive was needed in a place with this particular history, it really was talking, you know, to local residents, and especially the elders who lived, you know, in the city, who, you know, likely did not experience the race massacre directly. Well, in fact, they didn't, but their parents would have, you know. And so for me, you know, a lot of the book was, you know, really drawing on the resource, the archive of the kind of living archive of the community. Moreover, for me, the book shouldn't be read as a book about the race massacre. The book should be seen as, you know, a book about the kind of processes that created a place like Greenwood, the kind of broader processes that create what we can think of as anti-Black destruction that, you know, were represented, you know, in the 21 race massacre, but also the kind of narrative of, you know, community repair that I think is needed broadly when we think about Black life in the United States and really, in, you know, across the Americas. But for sure, you know, there were a lot of, you know, conventional archives that I was able to go to. There were a lot of community-based archives. The Greenwood Culture Center, for example, had a wonderful, you know, repository of primary resources. But the Greenwood Culture Center actually was a wonderful site, you know, to really meet community members, and especially community elders, that were really instrumental to, you know, writing this history.
Wonderful. I wonder if you could give us just a brief history of Greenwood and talk about sort of what helps to create a space like that.
Sure. So, you know, Greenwood should be seen really as being, you know, a variation of the what we know as the kind of historical all-Black town. You know, Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma, which we should note, became a state after Greenwood was founded. So Greenwood was founded in 1906 and Oklahoma became a state in 1907. But statehood, you know, followed what we can think of as the kind of period of Indian Territory, where the eastern part of the current state of Oklahoma was the site or the destination site of what we, you know, generally know as the Trail of Tears. So Indian removal, you know, effectively led, you know, native peoples from the southeastern United States, who we might also recognize as the five civilized tribes, to Indian Territory. And so following the General Allotment Act or the Dawes Act, you know, a lot of those lands became saleable. And, you know, there were, you know, Black native people, meaning, you know, members of these tribal societies that we would recognize as African-American or descendants of African-Americans or African enslaved persons in the United States, who also had access to these lands due to their tribal affiliations and memberships. And so their lands became saleable, and African-Americans really following the kind of the Exodus-er tradition, you know, in the kind of wake of the failure of Reconstruction, you know, Indian Territory found itself being, you know, increasingly populated by Black settlers from the South. And when they settled, you know, they formed communities, you know, they formed local governments, they formed industries, you know, commercial, social, cultural lives. And this took the form of what we now recognize as all Black towns. And so you're talking about, you know, a practice that goes back to the 1880s in Indian Territory specifically. And so Greenwood really, you know, follows in that tradition where you had some early Black entrepreneurs. Today we'd call them developers, I guess, you know, who were able to acquire about 40 acres or so of creek land in Tulsa. And, you know, on those 40 or so acres, they founded Greenwood. And, you know, as a result of them having access to capital and land, you know, and I guess will, you know, they formed the Greenwood District. And, you know, in many ways, it was modeled off of these all Black towns that had existed, you know, in Indian Territory for some time. And it, of course, existed all across the United States, right? I'm in California, we had an all Black town, you know, a couple here in California, there were, you know, all across the South. I mean, you know, so that history is there. And as a quick plug, I'd recommend people to go check out Carter Slocum's really fantastic book, you know, Black Towns, Black Futures, which gives a really wonderful detailing, not just of the history, but of the contemporary lives of all Black towns in Oklahoma. So Greenwood is basically an all Black town, but because it's in the city, you know, it basically is within the kind of jurisdiction of what becomes Tulsa proper. Or what is Tulsa proper? It is not, you know, a town per se, but a district, because Greenwood becomes annexed to the city of Tulsa in 1910. So about 3 years after statehood, Greenwood actually becomes a formal part of the city of Tulsa. And so most of its life is spent as a kind of district. And there, you know, there's this kind of baseline for economic activity, commercial activity. People are attracted to this place. You know, they bring their talents, they bring their, you know, their will, and you know, the Greenwood District develops as a site of what I would call, you know, a really respectable kind of commercial and cultural life. The Greenwood District is really marked by Greenwood Avenue, which, you know, is a primary thoroughfare where you have banks and shops and all kinds of leisure spaces. And there's, you know, churches and high schools and all kinds of things where, you know, becomes a heart of a black community. And so that's, you know, that's Greenwood. You know, people worked in largely secondary industries, because although Tulsa is a thriving oil center, you know, African Americans are largely barred from participating directly in the oil industry. But there is a lot of money in Tulsa because of oil, meaning a lot of money amongst the white residents of Tulsa. And so African Americans are able to kind of tap into the kind of like secondary and tertiary markets related to the oil industry. And so you have people who set up auxiliary businesses, people who are working in domestic labor or the general service industries. You know, you have, you know, Black Tulsans who, you know, again, you know, are money lenders, and there are whites who are borrowing from Black money lenders, you know what I mean, in Tulsa. So it really was a kind of interracial, you know, commercial space. You know, all made possible really by the circumstances of the oil industry, but then the concentration of wealth, I should, you know, if you can call it wealth. You know, it's important to note that a lot of Greenwood District was, you know, populated by poorer people, but still the wealth that was there, you know, the kind of Jim Crow segregationist codes meant that a lot of the Black, you know, Black wealth that was created in Greenwood was able to, was required to remain in Greenwood. And so that actually ended up, you know, facilitating a lot of commercial development in the district. And so as a result, you know, a variety of things, you know, flourished and were developed, and what you have was, I think, you know, people, you know, writers for papers like the Oklahoma Eagle and so forth would say, like, you know, Greenwood represented quintessential Americana. You know what I mean? Everybody, you know, had their Sunday best on a Sunday, was strolling down Greenwood Avenue, you know, living the kind of, you know, so-called American dream, although facilitated directly by Jim Crow segregation.
So, this work is sort of structured, as you say, around five analytical themes: violence, inheritance, restoration, repair, and territory. Could you just briefly explain what these themes mean in the context of the book, and then we can sort of get into the chapter by chapter there?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the thrust of the book is trying to get at, you know, as I said, the issue of the race massacre is an example of a kind of ongoing kind of violence that African Americans continue, you know, to face. And as I said, I'm on the reparations task force, and I can, you know, I can declare, you know, faithfully that, you know, California's Black history is very similar in the same way. You know, we can talk about Bruce's Beach here in Los Angeles, where, you know, Black families are owning land and developing businesses, and here comes the state, right, to undermine, you know, undermine those efforts. And so violence for me in the first chapter was really an attempt to try and get at, you know, the kind of state of anti-Blackness that the race massacre is only an example of, you know. And then moving forward, you know, through the remaining you know, analytics, I wanted to try and understand, you know, what the consequences of that violence were. And so inheritance was a way of thinking about that consequence, and that consequence as representing a kind of Black inheritance, you know. And so then restoration was, you know, an attempt to say, well, you know, that inheritance isn't the full story. You know what I mean? Like, when you go to Oklahoma, when you go to Tulsa, and you understand, you know, as I was able to, you know, the complexity and richness of Black life, you know, and historical Black life in the city, you quickly come to appreciate that there is an effort to to recover that history and to recover the life that you know, say, contemporary Black Tulsans ancestors, you know, once enjoyed. And so restoration was, you know, my attempt at trying to figure out how exactly the community were working at trying to get back there in a way. And then so repair was, you know, thinking about restoration, you know, moves us towards thinking about, you know, well, what are the means by which we can think, you know, reparations and repair? Because a restored community in this case would effectively be a repaired community. And so, you know, that's what the analytic is there for. And then, you know, I end in territory for a couple of reasons. You know, historically speaking, territory, you know, could in principle have served as the first chapter, right, where we're thinking historically about Indian territory. However, I place it last because I'm trying to make an argument for something, you know, beyond just the history of Greenwood, you know, by pointing towards and pointing out the kinds of lessons that Black life in Indian territory, you know, could share. And so that's the kind of, you know, I think that was the thinking, at least, as far as what these different analytics were trying to do in the book.
Wonderful. And so you already talked a little bit about chapter one, so let's just skip to chapter two. So you look at the sort of afterlives of the Tulsa Rioter Massacre. And the question, I guess, here from this for the listeners is, what sort of was or is the community in North Tulsa like after this massacre and after this riot?
I think to answer that, I do have to go back into chapter one very briefly, because I don't want the impression to be that chapter one is about the race massacre, right? Chapter one, I think, dedicates a total of like 15 pages to discussing the race massacre, and the reason why is that, you know, it's about showing that the race massacre, you know, appears as a kind of, you know, exceptional violence, but actually, you know, we think about the consequences of anti-Black violence, you know, we can in fact see it in much more unexceptional or seemingly unexceptional ways. And so in chapter one, I move from the race massacre to, you know, to make the case that, listen, you know, within 5 or so years following the race massacre, you know, Greenwood largely redeveloped, right? And that's part of the story that often gets left out. However, by 1930, you know, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, you know, comes in, part of that New Deal, you know, instrument of funding or defunding certain cities, you know, through access or denied access to, you know, to loans and capital. And so redlining basically comes in and represents another form of violence, which is then followed by what we can think of as urban renewal, you know, broadly understood, you know. So the highway comes in by the 1950s and does further damage by actually demolishing critical areas of Greenwood, you know, and that leads to, you know, the 1980s when you're thinking about, you know, the turn towards mass incarceration, you know, the war on drugs, war on poverty, and that ends up really setting the conditions for what I call in chapter two, you know, the inheritance. And so what that inheritance looks like in chapter two is a landscape that is, you know, completely opposite in many ways to, you know, what Greenwood was and looked like. You know, so Greenwood, being an active commercial, you know, area, you know, supplemented by lots of social life and cultural activities, you know, grocery stores, banks, etc. North Tulsa, right, which the general area is now recognized as, has none of those things really. So by the time I get to Tulsa in 2014, you know, there are no grocery stores in the community. You know, the education is largely provided through, you know, nonprofit and philanthropic means. You know, the EduCare primary schools or, you know, elementary schools are made possible by the George Kaiser, you know, Family Foundation. You know, groceries are provided through nonprofit mobile grocery stores that drive around neighborhoods. You know, most people are doing their shopping at quick stop gas stations. And so, you know, the inheritance looks, you know, looks like that, you know, the Greenwood that we know of, you know, from the histories of Black Wall Street, you know, isn't there. And so that's what North Tulsa looks like. It looks like what we might think of as, you know, an impoverished, you know, black space that is made so by the kind of typical mechanics of you know, state disinvestment, as well as over policing, as well as the attrition of you know, economic opportunity and the diminishing of healthcare services and educational access. So in many ways, this is what North Tulsa looks like in you know, in the contemporary moment, what Walter Rodney would call the kind of quintessential underdeveloped space, where the local community is wholly reliant on external sources for, you know, everyday existence.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and you go deeper into this in chapter three, right, where you talk about sort of community organizing around food access in North Tulsa. And so can you take us through what some of these community organizing efforts look like around this, and how they show sort of how the community works together to, as you say, sort of reconcile their circumstances with their history?
Sure. So, you know, when I get to Tulsa, you know, there's no grocery store. And so a lot of the community are concerned, you know, about food access, you know. And so, I mean, chapter three is basically, you know, a kind of in-depth ethnographic analysis of a grocery store-related community meeting, right? And so those of you who are listening, especially grad students, it's entirely fine for you to, you know, to have this kind of really, you know, concentrated and concerted, you know, emphasis on a particular moment, ethnographically, and to try and glean what understandings you can from that about broader processes and phenomenon. So the you know, chapter three is for me a really important chapter because, you know, as I said, you know, inheritance, the discussion inheritance is you know, we can see that in Miami, we can see that here in Oakland, we can see similar circumstances across, you know, various Black communities, you know, in the United States, right? That again, that have been, you know, undermined and underserved, and over-policed. And so chapter three for me was really a revelation, or what was happening in Tulsa that ended up being discussed in chapter three was really a revelation, because what I saw was a community that recognized what was happening, recognized, you know, the limitations, recognized, you know, the histories that brought them to where they were. But rather than say, well, listen, so and so did this to us, or that process happened to us, and so therefore that's why we are the way we are, or where we are, you know, where we are, you know, the narrative was one of community responsibility. It was one in which the community was saying, you know, only we can actually help ourselves, only we can change our circumstances. And so being able to detail that, I felt was a necessary kind of intervention into, you know, into the kind of discussion, you know, around Black poverty. And to be sure, you know, there is, you know, there really are countless examples of community organizers, you know, trying to advocate for this kind of, you know, self-reliance, if you will. But what was coming up was something that was deeper. It was something that was able to draw on the history of Greenwood and of Indian Territory, you know, which is to say, like, you know, I remember one guy in one of the meetings said something like, you know, our ancestors, you know, built Black Wall Street. You know, who are we asking someone else for a grocery store? You know, because this is what the community ended up getting in large parts. But, you know, the idea was, oh, well, let a nonprofit provide grocery access to us. And they're like, well, no, we shouldn't have to do that, because we know we can do more because our ancestors did more. And so for me, you know, in various areas, so there was a grocery store, there were, you know, organizers trying to, you know, do community rehabilitation and redevelopment, you know, through like relocation programs, you know, like getting people to move back to North Tulsa, you know, and trying to kind of generate community through that way. There were, you know, organizations and organizers working around commercial development, you know, getting grants to start businesses. So, you know, everything was happening in all of these kinds of ways, you know, in these different areas. But, you know, what was happening in this grocery store, you know, environment was something, you know, really critical, because it was about, you know, one of the more, you know, necessary kinds of resources, food. But it was something, you know, of a remarkable sense of place where, you know, or it represented a remarkable sense of place to me, where, you know, these locals realized that despite what, you know, what their circumstances were, they actually had ownership over this place in a way that I didn't think I've ever seen, you know, in other kind of community discourses. Their sense was, this is our home, right? This is our land. This is our inheritance. And only we can actually fix it. And so for me, that really was the kind of major takeaway, you know, from that grocery store meeting and from, you know, that chapter in the book.
All right. So chapter 4 looks at Black Tulsans articulations of repair and how that extends sort of beyond common slavery-based reparations. So what are Black Tulsans articulations of reparations, and how does this go beyond how we typically think of sort of Black African-American slavery-based reparations?
Right. Okay. So, you know, what I saw in Tulsa, you know, was a discourse where, you know, Black life started, you know, for them in a particular moment, in a particular geography. And you know, that for them was Oklahoma. That for them was Greenwood. In many ways, you know, that led to a kind of deprivileging, if you will, of the narrative of Black life starting in the South and in the plantation space during the period of slavery. And you know, of course, that's not to say that, you know, Black Tulsans don't recognize that their ancestors, you know, were enslaved and came from the South in many ways, although the history of Indian removal, you know, to Indian territory shows that Black life in Indian territory, later Oklahoma, does have, you know, multiple starting points, not just, you know, with slavery, but within the kind of Black native kind of, you know, cosmology, if you will. But still, for them, they recognized that Greenwood represented, you know, their origin story. And reparations for them was meant to, you know, effectively get back to what we can think of as Black life as organized, you know, by that notion of Greenwood and that actual experience and history of Greenwood. And so reparations, you know, again, while not discounting that I think many Black Tulsans would recognize that reparations for, you know, slavery of African Americans would be appropriate. For them, you know, they were advocating for the particular injury that was a disruption of the life that they were able, or their ancestors were able, to create despite that history of slavery. And I think it's an important lesson, because when we actually think about post-emancipation Black life, we actually do have really, a plethora of examples of African Americans accomplishing a great deal of social and cultural and economic development. You know, what we do know is that I would argue that almost as critical, and I guess this is the argument of the book, almost as critical as the injury of slavery has been the kind of injury of post-emancipation anti-Blackness. And so we think about Greenwood, you know, as an exceptional Black space, you know, founded again, barely, 50 years or so after, you know, after emancipation. But what we also know is that during that same period, you know, African Americans owned almost 14% of agricultural land in this country. We know that at the height of Jim Crow in 1910, you know, there were over 100 Black-owned banks in this country. When we look at the statistics today, you're talking about, you know, African-American-owned land, you know, having gone down to just over 1%. You're talking about, you know, just barely over a dozen or so, you know, Black-owned banks in the United States. And so, you know, in many ways, you know, the question of repair that North Tulsans, you know, really demand that we ask is the question about, well, how do we identify, you know, injury in the history of African American life, and how do we actually prioritize, you know, what injuries do need accounting for? Because we tend to, you know, oftentimes in our narratives of reparations in this country, you know, really emphasize African American slavery. And it should be emphasized, to be sure. But we have to make sure that we give equal weight, I would argue, and that might be a controversial statement, but I think we have to actually give equal weight, you know, to the kinds of post-emancipation injuries that African Americans faced and continue to face today. And so that's what the kind of notions of reparations and repair, you know, I take away from at least the North Tulsa case, that I think are really broadly applicable, you know, to the general African American context in the U.S.
Totally. And so you've already spoken a little bit about Chapter 5. I was really interested in this notion that you talk about, that Black place is already and always contingent and determined by existing racist structures, and that that's how we typically think about sort of Black place. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your argument in that chapter, and maybe touch upon that notion that sort of underlines the way that we tend to think about sort of Black spaces.
Yeah, so the point is that, you know, I wanted to somewhat, you know, I won't say disrupt, right? Because, you know, I don't want to try and deny that a lot of, you know, Black relations to place are actually contingent and completely marked by racism. That's the truth. But it's not the only truth, right? And so, and I think as important as it is to kind of detail the kind of histories of harm, and that's part of my actual work, you know, as a task force member on the California Reparations Task Force, who spent over a year just going through the gruesome work of and harrowing work of just hearing the kind of testimonies and histories of anti-Black violence in the state's history. But, you know, there were also a lot of other stories, right, that in many ways preceded the violence. So I talk about Greenwood, you know, I talk about Indian Territory. And what does it mean for us to actually identify, you know, Black spatial relations, you know, that are affirming, that are productive, that are positive? You know, once you identify them, you begin to understand that actually, you know, the primary thrust of anti-Black violence is a violence that directly attacks, you know, Black relationality, Black people's relations to each other and to place. And so, you know, it's interruptive violence, in other words. And so for me, it's important for us to understand and to then to begin to prioritize and privilege, you know, that work, which helps to identify, if not celebrate, but at least to identify and to think from, you know, these more affirming and productive Black, you know, Black spatial relations and community relations. And so with Chapter 5, the territory, you know, my objective in that chapter was to, you know, was to give a history of that process. And, you know, in detailing, you know, what Black settlers, you know, to Indian Territory were able to do, how they were able to really, you know, remap, you know, their existence and their futures because of this kind of relationship to land that they were able to and to place as a result, that they were able to develop, you know, I think really represents a kind of, you know, an ideal example for how we should think about, you know, post reparations, you know, Black community development. And so, in other words, if we get something called reparations, if we acquire something called reparations, if we demand something called reparations, the question that immediately follows is, well, what do we do now, right? And I think that looking prior to that moment, looking for and cataloging the kinds of, again, productive and affirming and affirmative relations to place in African American history gives us a roadmap, in other words, for what I think, you know, African Americans should do upon receipt of or successful receipt of reparations. But even absent reparations, right, because we have to remember, post-emancipation, African Americans did not get reparations. And so despite having reparations, they were still able to build these communities, still able to build these lives. And so really, even beyond the scope of receiving reparations, right, Indian Territory and its history, you know, tells us a lot about what, you know, Black community formation could look like. And so in that chapter, I try to detail really some of the processes and some of the techniques and the ethics, especially, that led to kind of post-emancipation African-American community development that went on to found things like All Black Towns and then, to, you know, to kind of inspire and direct something like the Greenwood District prior to its violent, you know, interruption in 1921.
Absolutely. And so at the end of your introduction, you write Justice for Greenwood. And so I just wanted to circle back to that, right? So circling back to this idea of reparations beyond how we typically think of them, from the conversations that you had with Black Tulsans, what does Justice for Greenwood mean?
Justice for Greenwood, well, one, there is a, you know, there is an organization, or at least an organizational movement, you know, coordinated around this notion of Justice for Greenwood. Justice for Greenwood is a statement demanding reparations for the history of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. You know, but for me, Justice for Greenwood, even beyond, I think, some of the more obvious kind of directives and inspirations, is me advocating for a full recognition of what Greenwood was and what Greenwood actually is. Because, you know, part of the argument in the book is that, listen, there are actually Black people today who live in Greenwood, right? Greenwood is not a dead space. Greenwood is not a forgotten space. Greenwood is not a historical space, or at least not only a historical space. And so for me, it is about looking comprehensively, you know, at Greenwood as a community, as a living community, and one that is working towards repair, reparations. And I think, in asking for justice for Greenwood, you know, I'm asking, you know, for justice for, you know, all of the Black communities, you know, whose members, both, you know, in the past and today, are working, you know, to restore themselves, are working to repair, you know, their community relations and to build something new, you know, for themselves and for their, you know, for their, you know, their children. And so, Justice for Greenwood is that, you know, it is a reparative declaration, but it is a call to recognize, you know, the actually living, you know, actually living community of Greenwood today.
Perfect. And what sort of audience did you imagine for this work?
You know, the audience for me was a, the audience for me was everyone who is interested in the question of, you know, Black community development, everyone who is interested in the kind of history of the way that, you know, U.S. Capital and development has worked through the effective and intentional destruction of African American and other minority communities. It was also really, you know, an attempt to help think with other Black studies scholars, because what I wanted, and especially in the chapter on Indian Territory, what I wanted was to introduce this language of sovereignty, you know, into the kind of, or rather reintroduce this language of sovereignty, you know, into the kind of North American Black studies, you know, discourse. there is a lot of emphasis on notions of freedom and unfreedom, the freedom to be to gain, the long emancipation in Black studies in the US. But I also wanted us to recognize the many freedoms that Black Americans have already achieved and how those freedoms have continuously been interrupted. And so for me, you know, if I were to be honest, that's really the emphasis, right? Is to say Black people have been free, Black people are free. But what we have been facing is a continuous assault on our freedom. And so I think by a simple shift in perspective around this issue, we end up opening up a whole kind of realm of possibilities for how to understand the complexity of Black life. Because otherwise we end up becoming complicit in the kind of limiting, the making singular of the Black narrative. And I think we can only accomplish what we all hope for in reparations or overall, you know, liberation as an ongoing practice by recognizing the complexity and the multiplicity of Black life and its many narratives.
All right. Well, Dr. Lewis, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you again for being so gracious with your time. So I'll just ask one final question here. What are you working on now?
Yeah, thank you. So I am currently working on a couple of projects. You know, one is trying to think through the question of reparations, you know, as a result of you know, my total scholarship, as well as my ongoing work, actually doing, you know, reparations. And I think, you know, what's really important is recognizing and trying to think through some of the activities that I've been able to and have been required to take part in as a member of the task force in California. So what I'll say is that, you know, part of my scope of responsibility is overseeing the economics team that is actually calculating the harms African-Americans have experienced in the state. And so I want to think through that process of calculation. I want to think through the kind of long-term principles of Black life, right, as a kind of what we might think of as a value proposition in the United States. I am interested in thinking about, you know, what does, you know, Black life post repair, if not reparations, actually look like. So I'm thinking through a whole host of these kinds of related processes to come towards something of a, I guess we could call it a full theory of reparations. You know, something that does take into account not just the injuries African Americans have experienced and continue to experience, but also, again, the many futures, you know, that Black life, you know, can be. And then I'm also, you know, working on a project on, you know, really dealing with this question of Black relations, you know, how we might think through, you know, this history of what actually constitutes Blackness in the Atlantic world. And so, yeah, more to come. But at the moment, you know, I'm a department chair, you know, I am working on the task force. You know, we're about to issue our final recommendation in the next few months. You know, we issued an interim report last year, which is a 500-page detailing of the history of anti-Black harms in the state of California. We are about to issue, you know, our final recommendation, which is about another 200 pages of recommendations across 12 areas of harm for African Americans. And thinking through, you know, all of that will take a little bit of time. And I hope to get to, you know, these next projects as soon as I can after a little bit of rest, I think.
Absolutely. I know that we all want to thank you for the work that you've done, both this work that we're talking about now and also the work on the reparations project. So thank you very much for that. Thank you also for your time today. And I want to thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed the conversation, and take care.
Thank you so much, Amari. It's been a pleasure.